We have our commentators with us, I think, so that's great. A very good morning to Stephen Mills and to Bridget Morton.
Morning, Catherine.
Stephen, Executive Director of UMR Research, former political advisor to two Labor governments. Bridget Morton, Senior Consultant with public and commercial law firm Franks and Ogilvy, a former senior ministerial advisor for the previous National-led government. A lot to get through. Let's start with 4 o'clock, the announcement and what Cabinet is considering right as we speak. Expectations are huge. Bridget, what will they be finally thrashing out there today?
Well, I think they've basically thrashing out how they will announce Alert Level 2. I think the decision on whether or not we will go to Alert Level 2 is kind of done and dusted. The expectations have been raised too high. There's no willingness, I think, from the New Zealand public to just play the ball now. They're looking for movements, they're looking to be able to get back to some sort of role of normality, and this is particularly important for those whose livelihoods have been affected.
The possibility of a staged approach, especially when you're looking at some of the countries that had got down to very low numbers, and as in South Korea, there were problems with just one patron actually going between nightclubs. Do you think, yeah, Bridget, that sort of outcard that the Prime Minister kept in her pocket to do this in a phased manner, would that fly?
Well, I think it's a little bit confusing to talk about a staged approach, because I think that's what people think the alert levels are. If that's not a staged approach, if you're going to sort of now bring in, you know, alert level 2.5 after last Thursday you announced what alert level 2 looks like, I think people are going to get even more confused about what they can and can't do, and that means that people are going to be less likely to actually follow those rules.
Stephen.
Yeah, well, I think despite expectations, the decision, and it is a huge, huge call, should be primarily based on health advice that's tested by Cabinet. But I fully agree with what Bridget's saying. I think expectations that the move to level two are strong. The number of new cases has stayed really small, and in some places, the number of actual active cases is pretty much non-existent. But I think if there was any kind of pause to going to level two, government would be absolutely flayed by business. I mean, people have kind of made appointments at hairdressers and things like that, so it's quite sort of hard to stop that momentum. I still think, as I said last week, that if there was a poll on it, you might get quite a different result from what we're expecting to see from the basically the kind of main direction of media coverage. I think there's still a lot of anxious people out there. They're worried about asymptomatic transmission. They know one or two idiots, you know, that South Korean case is sort of a real warning that can get the virus moving again. They're uncomfortable with all the evidence that people aren't adhering to the rules, and they're quite destabilised by overseas resurgences in Singapore and now Germany. As I say, I think I agree with Bridget that, and I think, you know, obviously you have to get moving at some point. On phasing, I think that I agree as well. I think that's really difficult to do. People kind of make the leap as soon as an announcement that there will be an announcement that we're at that stage anyway. It seems to be happen both in Australia and New Zealand, so it'll be very difficult to manage. And the only way that could happen, I think, is if it's really clear, like no pubs or no domestic travel or no restaurants. It'd have to be absolutely unmistakable what the sort of 2.5 or 2.6 stage was.
They'd been waiting to get through this first full incubation cycle since moving to level three, which I think is, if not at 14 days, we must be just about there. It's getting hard to keep track of things, isn't it? But Bridget, on the question of how this decision gets communicated, to Stephen's point, once someone hears something, they're off and running mentally. And does she need to think about that when announcements get made this afternoon? Any clear messaging they need to get out ahead of saying what's going to happen, they need to front load, and it needs to be priority stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's probably the key thing, is actually making it really clear to people about what they can and can't do today compared to what they may be able to do on Thursday, for instance, when that 14 days does conclude. I think also that Stephen's absolutely right, that people sort of take it as a given. You were seeing, like, there was a bit of a surge over the weekend of breaches of the current alert level. I noticed around town, which I'm sure many people did, a lot more movement, a lot more cars. So I think this kind of goes further into that sort of expectations that people, even if there's a continuance of alert level 3 for another week, in reality, it's probably not going to be realised.
Here's the other thing. If it's made on the basis of health decisions, Stephen, and certainly that's what we've been told, we are down to the numbers we're down to. We must be just about through that entire cycle they were waiting for over level three. If they're not at a point of going soon, you've got to ask what's the hold-up, and then the questions come back onto whether they have confidence in their tracing and tracking and response should there be, as they anticipate, some more cases. If they're not ready to go, they're going to have to explain in considerable detail why they're not ready to go.
And I think it'll be difficult to convince people, and it'll probably be seen as a failure of government on that tracking and tracing thing. But that's the decision they have to make. You know, if they're not confident they can stamp out an outbreak, I mean, people have got used to those numbers being really, you know, 0, 2, 3 now. If they start going up again, I think, you know, the level of public confidence in what's going on will fall dramatically, and it may be better to wait a bit longer. I don't think they'll do that. You know, that's not my expectation. But if that's the health advice, that the tracking and tracing is not ready to stamp out the inevitable outbreaks when there's much more human contact, well, then that's the decision that should be made.
Bridget, how are you seeing?
Then you'll be the best communicator in the world.
When you look at where they've got to on that, I think the latest statements we saw, they've had another audit done by Dr. Aisha Verrill, the infectious diseases expert who did their audit. I saw a press statement come out from the health minister's office, be nice to talk, and we keep asking, saying they're now at 5 out of 8, I think, key indicators being reached. There's still a question over whether the number of days it takes to track and trace 80% would be the same at 100 cases as it is when they were down to an average of 8, I counted, over the 2 weeks they assessed. So is that something that really ought to be front-footed now, where that capability is at, especially if we go into this transition?
Yeah, I think absolutely. But I think one thing we need to be careful about is that whilst you might want to look at, well, you should be looking at this decision from a public health point of view, you can't look it into it just as a vacuum of the coronavirus. Because we know, like, during this period that I think it's about 20,000 elective surgeries have been put off, 60,000 specialist appointments have been put off. There's a question about actually what the lockdown is doing to wider health outcomes, not to mention the whole mental health aspect of it. So when you're looking at a public health instance, I think it's a bit narrow just to look at whether or not we can contact trace people.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is they need to have that up to speed. We don't want to go back to where we've been. And it is still taking time, it seems, to get to 100% of the capability they were told to get. And I understand these things aren't simple, but
I can completely see why there is confusion around this, because you look at Australia and Australia's had their app up and running, which may not be the best solution, I don't know, but they have had it up and running, I think, for about 10 days now, had quite a large download factor. The Prime Minister over there has really strongly communicated to people that this is a key KPI for them being able to essentially come out of lockdown. So it is confusing on this side of the Tasman why we haven't seen that same level of discussion around the direct link between the ability to contact trace and where we're at with it and the ability to come out of lockdown.
Let's talk about the budget on Thursday. As you just heard, there's 700 jobs going at Sky City by the sound of it. We're already well over 40,000 over the period of the lockdown or a little bit before, and projections for unemployment getting very high. There are so many ways to come at this. How do you try and stem any job losses, and can you? And then how do you cope with unemployment on that scale? What is your expectation out of Thursday's budget, Stephen?
Well, I think it's going to be very focused on jobs. I think we're kind of moving into that second stage, the response, rebuild, grow, the three stages that Grant Robertson's been talking about. And that'll be very much about delivering, you know, the major priority will be job protection, and that'll include business support. I think kind of more in the health area as well. And it's not a normal budget, is it? It's not going to set out everything for the coming year. It's just going to be another stage in the response. The forecasts in it are going to be really bad, though they're going to be really speculative. There's $30 billion still in the fiscal envelope to spend, but I don't think all that will be spent. But, I mean, just to put it in perspective, the wage subsidy exceeded the operating allowance for the whole first term of this government. And, you know, Grant Robertson said he had $3 billion to spend in the budget just last December, which has completely changed. But no, I think the main area will be jobs. I mean, I think it'll still be clearly a Labor or a centre-left budget with investment in recovery in areas like schools, health and environment. Environment, be interesting to see what they do there, whether notice is taken of what the Greens have been advising, because that's an area where you don't need a lot of retraining to create jobs. You know, and for those who tramp, you know, you see the wildling pines anywhere, sort of kind of that kind of initiative, I think, would be very welcome.
Go ahead, Bridget.
So I completely agree with Stephen that I think the main sort of buckets of cash we're going to be looking at, that recovery phrase. I think it's still a little bit actually unknown how much money has been spent, particularly in those key areas of health and education and in housing so far, and how much of a burden that is going forward. I think everyone's sort of looking towards that sort of next cliff, which is the end of the wage subsidy in 12 weeks, and what is the next step from there. I think if Robertson doesn't announce on Thursday some sort of plan to sort of support workers and businesses from that point on, I think that will be quite a major disappointment.
The debt figures... Go ahead, Steve.
I'm just saying, that's got a scale of assistance needed. It sort of must be kind of almost impossible to kind of wrestle with it. I just wrote down what I remembered seeing on TV in terms of the, you know, industries in distress over the last couple of weeks. There's moteliers, GPs, pharmacists, the media, flower growers, florists, the tertiary and secondary education, tourism, of course, dentists, gymnasiums, regional airlines, fertility clinics, and a lot of those were, you know, all but demanding significant packages. So, you know, how you work through all those priorities is a, you know, really, really difficult task.
The debt figures will be frightening, and Treasury projections, as Stephen points out, they're going to move around, but they will be enormous. And we were discussing this with the economists earlier, Bridget. No one wants to start, well, government won't want to start talking about how that debt is ultimately repaid, because it wants to be in a stimulatory frame of mind. It wants people spending. It doesn't want them to be thinking about more taxes coming down the road, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I saw figures this morning from ASB that, you know, projecting at worst case that we could be in $50,000 per household in government debt. And I think one of the major problems, particularly for Labor looking forward, is the fact that that debt's going to fall on our younger generations, which for many of them, they've really felt the brunt of this lockdown, because they are tend to be more our casual workers, our students, they don't have large resources. They've been going into a recession economy with their first jobs, and then they're going to have this debt sitting over the top of them. So that's going to be, I don't think, something that we're going to see a real discussion of on Thursday. I don't think people are in that real frame of mind. But I think overall people's concerns about where spending is going will have an impact on how much they feel as a household that they can spend, and whether they take on further consumer debt, for instance.
I think people understand that the government has to spend at the moment, otherwise the economy might not come out the other side. And, you know, concerns about debt have to be put aside. You know, we do start, as is often pointed out, from a very strong position with our debt as a percentage of GDP, around 20%, you know, and compared to Australia, which is 45%, Japan 238%. USA 106, you know, Michael Cullen deserves an enormous amount of credit for that and the way he managed the books during the boom that the last Labor government presided over. So there is a stronger base to sort of build on. And I mean, we can, I think, go to 50%. You know, the world's going to be awash with debt. And even if we go from 20% to 50%, you know, we'll still be in a stronger position than most economies.
Yeah, but ultimately, looking at us comparatively to other economies doesn't provide us with the resources we need on the ground. And I'm not going to pretend to do some amateur economics here, but I think we need to spend time looking at what our resources we've got and what we can spend as a country. Therefore, looking at other countries' debt doesn't actually provide us with that much helpful information.
Looking historically where we've been possibly does, and there's a good few people doing that at the moment, but while also acknowledging we have never had a hit like this to our economy. One person who is trying to push it is Simon Bridges. I watched him in the House the other day pushing the Prime Minister over the prospect of new or raised taxes. She batted a lot away. She still said no CGT. They're just not going to go there. National might raise it, but they're just not going to go there, are they, Stephen?
No, I mean, I don't think, well, it's, you know, we could have an election without tax really being an issue at all, I guess. I guess National will try and push that, you know, Labor will have to increase taxes, but I don't think that's a sort of realistic prospect. You know, when an economy is absolutely reeling, I mean, who would increase taxes? I think that's highly unlikely. And similarly, it would seem to me, I mean, some in Australia have been raising a kind of far-right agenda of smacking up what's left of the industrial relations system and reducing taxes. But, you know, the government's tax revenues are going to plunge. There's going to be enormous needs in health. It wouldn't seem overly plausible to kind of try and campaign on a tax cut either. So we may be spared a tax election. I doubt it, actually, but it's a possibility we may be spared a tax election for the first time for a long, long time.
Let's talk about these questions over the legal underpinnings of lockdown gaining momentum. They were around about during lockdown. There were conversations over the wording of the Health Act, the Section 70 in particular, and which was one of the components on which the government used to introduce the lockdown. They've gained momentum significantly with a judicial challenge now, which is exactly where it should happen. What is your take on the problems this causes for the government, Bridget?
Well, ultimately, this has been an exercise in some of the most coercive powers that we've seen in sort of the last century in New Zealand in terms of the whole population. So there is a very relevant test here. I think also we need to be concerned that, unfortunately, a pandemic, you know, repeat, a new virus is not out of the question. And how we can actually respond to that in the future largely comes down to how we responded this time and whether people are on board with that. So ultimately, this legal test is incredibly important. Whether or not it has any impact on the government's political framing, I'm not sure that it does, because people ultimately will look at the results of the lockdown versus how they got there.
At the legal level, I mean, it's not something that I can speak of with any authority, but the government has declared absolute confidence that it does have appropriate authority to take the measures it did under Level 3 and Level 4 under the Public Health Act and the Declaration of the National Emergency. And in fact, David Parker seems more concerned about the kind of constitutional breach of summoning kind of leading officials, Solicitor General, the Director General of Health and the Police Commissioner, and trying to force them to breach privilege in front of that select committee. In terms of the politics, I think New Zealanders will see what's happened regardless of whether they have any kind of interest whatsoever in the legal underpinnings as absolutely proportionate and sensible in the circumstances. And I think if National's going to go down this road, it will backfire badly. It's sort of enormously kind of helpful to the government if that's where they're concentrating their fire. And I think there's a kind of risk that people will perceive the pursuit on this count, and I'm not saying it's not unimportant, but in terms of how politics works, as an attempt to undermine confidence in the measures taken and to encourage those who are breaching the conditions. And I think that would be a very dangerous space for them to end up in.
It would be very.
I disagree with that. I think proportionality is actually the key here. And one of the issues you've got is that those people, and you look at the official advice that was released over the weekend about greengrocers and butchers, who officials did prepare an option that they could be open. Those people are the ones that are going to be looking at, was the action from the government and what they enforced against us proportionate to the actual risk of a contagion? What was that proportionality is actually completely key to this argument, particularly when you look across the Tasman and you look at Australia, who didn't come down in the same level of enforcement and has had similar results to us. So I think to say that we've just, everyone's on board, that this was absolutely the right response at the right degree is completely wrong. And I think you're going to see more and more of that debate going forward as it's clear how many jobs have been lost.
It's really important that the powers are clarified, because this debate started fairly early, actually, in lockdown, and could have become undermining of the public confidence. Right, the place to test it, undoubtedly, is the courts, where the most experienced legal minds in the country argue to and fro in front of further legal experienced minds. And you do not want to be exposed to this raising its head again at a time where you cannot take an urgent injunction or an urgent case to the court. It's pivotal it gets resolved, Stephen.
Well, I think there's time to do it as we go into further levels, and they are doing it with level two, making sure that that is all kind of ticked off without it being part of a national emergency. I think there's got to be caution with Australia, that that's kind of like becoming almost a myth that, you know, it's got better results or the same results with a much lighter lockdown. Our per capita COVID cases were well ahead of Australia at the start of this process, and we were on a much more dangerous path and actually caught up and went ahead of Australia in terms of per capita cases. Their hospitalisation rates have been higher, and there's lots of state by state differences. Victoria is really tough. In Queensland, they're coming out of their lockdown on next Saturday, but the restaurants and pubs are only allowed to have 10 people in them, not 100. They can't kind of travel throughout Australia. They can only take 150-kilometre day trips. They're only allowed 5 people in their house. So I think there's a lot of time before we'll see what were actually the most successful strategies, and there seems to be quite a lot of evidence that the tighter lockdowns are actually better for the economy. It doesn't look like there's going to be any Swedish economic miracle now in articles that came out over the weekend, and I think people, if the lockdown's been successful and got those cases down to really low levels, New Zealanders are going to go back into the economy, you know, with a lot more confidence than say people in America are, where they're, you know, releasing the conditions while numbers of cases are still going up. So I think it's not as simple as saying, you know, Australia was the model we should have followed.
I do think the legal question stands separate to that, Bridget, right?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
I was going to say, I think the legal question stands separate to that. If it's about the rule of law and it's about future compliance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we need to be really careful, you know, we talk about rule of law and it seems that it's kind of a discussion amongst, you know, the legal profession or those in the sort of political circles, but actually the rule of law protects our most vulnerable people, and that's why it's so important that we get it right.
OK, now let's talk about that. Sorry, Stephen.
Well, so I'm not a barrister, so I want to be as small as possible a target on this compared to Bridget. But, I mean, I can report that, you know, everybody I've asked and the statements by the government, are they confident that there was an appropriate legal underpinning for levels 3 and levels 4?
They're probably not going to state otherwise. And the other thing is there are retrospective powers at their discretion as well, Bridget. I would imagine, were there to be found to have been failings?
Yeah, I mean, there is that possibility. I think that would be a very dangerous thing for them to do. I think also that we just need to go back to something really simple too, with in terms of the law, is that people were confused about what they could and couldn't do. So they didn't actually know what their responsibilities were. And we had clients coming to us in the first sort of week and saying, can we do this or can we do this? And we would look at the legal instruments and say, well, actually, it's not stopping you from doing it, but that's quite a different rhetoric than what's coming from the Prime Minister and the Police Commissioner. So in terms of what their rights and responsibilities under the law compared to what you might put as, they say, moral rights and responsibilities, that's actually a really important question so that people know what they're meant to be doing.
I mean, that's the nub of it. As we said, we all haven't gone through all this and are doing silly walks all over the pavement because we think we'll be arrested if we don't. It's a mix of the moral imperative, but the legal underpinnings are important, and especially those who are paying with their businesses and their jobs. Look, we must just quickly wrap, because it's important. The big dump of documents, we've alluded to some of them on Friday, but also this email that came out accompanying them. Your observations, each of you, of the wording of it and whether it was one person's failure or reflective of perhaps wider matters to be concerned about when it comes to attitude.
Well, I think the only thing to be concerned... You go, Bridget.
Sorry. I think, I mean, the fact that there was a crisis communications policy in place in terms of restricting who could speak is not unusual for the government. I think in times like this, you do want one clear voice, and we've seen over the last few weeks when a few other ministers have got involved that hasn't gone well. But the arrogance that smacked of, that they didn't have to explain, that they didn't have to be accountable and transparent, was just mind-blowing.
I thought some of the criticism of it was just completely ridiculous. So I think that statement about that the objections could be dismissed definitely read as hubristic. I mean, I think it was probably only somebody who's been completely exhausted working 18 hours a week, because, you know, it would have been pretty obvious that the media would react pretty badly to it. I think in terms of other aspects of it, you know, I don't think there's much substance in the criticism at all. Message discipline's been around since Roman times, and I think it's especially critical during a pandemic. The material release was a proactive release. It didn't have to be released. And in terms of the timing, when did the media want it to be released? If it had been released on Thursday, it would have been seen as obscured by the announcement on the conditions of level two. If it was released before the 1 p.m. press conference, the media would have said they had no time to read it to ask questions. If it was released afterwards, they'd have said they wouldn't have been able to ask questions at the press conference. If it was released today, you've got the announcement of level two today, so it'll be seen to be overshadowed by that. If it was released tomorrow, well, then that's 4 or 5 days after they got it. So, you know, I think that that one statement was very clumsy and poor, and has been subject to deserved criticism. But in terms of the release and its timing, I don't see a huge substance in the criticisms of it.
Yeah, one would hope it is not a more widely held attitude being reflected there. But anyway, sometimes that old thing about sunshine being the best detergent, or daylight being the best detergent.
I think it shows the government are really right, that, you know, they've made decisions over an extraordinary number of government areas under enormous pressure and with huge complexity. And most of them, I think they've got right. That's what I'd take from that.
Refusing to do interviews and to say we don't need to because everyone thinks we're great, that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, the second part of that I agree with. But in terms of the way politics works, if a minister did falter and, you know, got the message wrong, didn't handle the questions well, that would be the story. And I mean, I know maybe it should be the story, but, you know, like in terms of managing it, you know, the media would have run a disarray story if there was any gap between what the Prime Minister's saying and any one of the ministers interviewed.
Well,
that's just politics.
They should be saying the same thing, because that's what is key in the times like this, that we should have a clear communication strategy. And we've got to remember too that we're all celebrating in the first weeks of lockdown that, you know, Jacinda Ardern was being applauded around the world for a communication strategy. So if you're going to take the credit, you have to take the criticism when it's due.
Thank you, both of you. Bridget Morton, thanks. Also, Stephen Mills.